Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a cup of coffee-flavored holy water, and two very special union members with me today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. But before we dive into this week's episode, I have one special message from the Mimic Preservation Society. For the price of just a follow, like, and leaving a comment, you can feed a starving mimic in a dungeon near you. So, for the sake of saving a mimic, please follow the Dungeon Plunger podcast on all the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, X, and even TikTok. We'd be extremely grateful. All right, so, as I was saying, this week we have not one, but two union members with us. Jeffrey Jones.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me, Jason.
My pleasure. Jeff is the kingpin behind RPG Ramblings and a zine all about selling organs on the black market, specifically about some guys named Gary's Appendix. In addition, we have Adam Kovac, fiction author, journalist, RPG writer, and paratrooper. Welcome to the show, guys.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
And I love this fresh union card that I now can put in my wallet. I'll carry it proudly.
Dungeon safety is really important, and it's not talked about enough. Just to kind of start things off, we don't need to go too deep into it, but and maybe I'll start with you, Jeff, and then I'll move on to you, Adam. Can you give us just a brief snippet of how you got into RPGs?
Oh, yeah, it goes. I mean, for me, it was back in 81, and I think it goes. I got the is the Molday box. I always get confused which one it is, but I got the basic D&D, and I'm not sure where I got it, but I remember getting it, opening it, loving it, and trying to get friends to run it. I don't know I don't know the level at my like eighth grade brain was able to properly run, but I was hooked from the minute I saw those comic book ads in the back of Marvel Comics.
How about you, Adam? How did you, where did your start begin?
You know, pretty much the same as Jeffrey. He's a little older than I am, but I started out, I can't remember how old I was, but I remember getting the blue Dungeons and Dragons book. It was just one book. I started off with that, and this was during like the Satanic Panic was going on. My mother was a devout Catholic, and she was just terrified of all the terrible things that were gonna happen to my soul if I played this game. But you know what? She was also cool about it, and she educated herself a little bit. She like sat me down, and I like went through character creation with her, and I wasn't really into being a dungeon master. I was still learning the game. And, you know, I played like a little scenario with her or whatnot, where her character, you know, fought a skeleton. And she was like, okay, all right, this is fine. You can keep playing this. You know, there's no.
As she grew bored and her eyes glazed over.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. But, you know, fortunately, my group of friends also got into it, and everybody started buying their own stuff. And then, you know, the second edition came out, and we all started playing that, and that was like a mainstay through high school D&D. But I was one of the guys who branched off into other games, like like Star Frontiers and Gamma World, and I got the Traveler little black book box set and Morrow Project. I mean, I can just go on and on and on and on. So some of us would run other games and whatnot, and I started out just like a lot of people did, and probably have the same stories and similar stuff. I used to go to conventions when I was an early teenager, and I, ended up playing with a lot of adults as well, who are looking back really cool and patient to, you know, to include this, you know, obnoxious 15-year-old in their gaming group, these longtime gaming groups, with them. And, I ended up, just walking away, when I was around 17, and didn't play at all for almost over 30 years.
Holy cow.
Until during, I had a huge hiatus, so to speak. And it was during the pandemic when we were all locked up, and I was like, wow, you know, I think I read an article somewhere about Roll20, and, you know, it was helping people connect, through not only this ordeal, but, you know, it just, you can play with people in Germany. You can play all over the place. You just have to arrange the time. And I thought that was really cool. And then I got to thinking, I was like surfing YouTube or something. And I came across like Seth Skorskowski's like Traveler blog or Traveler channel. And I was like, you know, Traveler was like one of those games that I always loved, you know, but never really got a chance to play. So I got into it again. I started role playing and whatnot. And a few years ago, I think it was on Twitter, wasn't it, Jeff? But I posted something about writing a novella for an IP, for a role-playing game IP, and how hard that was to get it published. And Jeff was like, oh, hey, that's cool. Do you want to come on my podcast and talk about it?
That's how they get you.
And, yeah, and we can probably get into it a little more in the episode here, but that was how I kind of got into writing and developing, you know, role-playing game adventures and settings of my own.
That's rad, man. So, Jeff, did you have a period when you stopped gaming, or were you pretty much solid from the time that you started till now?
No, it wasn't as long as Adam's, but I think it was probably, it was, you know, getting married, having kids about that time. So probably mid-20s too. And then I started I think I was probably my late 30s. I started to kind of go through the books and found a group, and we started playing a little bit of Champions here and there. I tried to get my son involved. That was kind of a fun thing that we could do. So, and that worked out for, and so, yeah. And I also, you know, the funny thing too, that time period, I thought role-playing games was, you know, it seemed like they were dying. It was dead. Like it was over with, but, you know, at least I had Champions, at least I had Traveler, and that's okay. But come to the end, it wasn't the apocalypse. Things exploded after that. So
one of the things that I was curious about was, how did RPG Rambling start? Did you start with the idea of publishing and then you started the podcast as part of that, or was the podcast, did you start with the podcast first?
So, yeah, I started with the podcast because there were types of things, and there are types of conversations about role-playing games that I wasn't finding out there. And I tried to hijack a cast and mastermind to see if I could get those types of guests I'd want to hear, those types of questions. Didn't really work out. So I thought, I'll just do my own. And I just decided to talk to people who are creating about the process and about the struggles and how the sausage is made. And then there's a certain point where I decided to start publishing. And then it was, well, what do I call it? And then it's like, well, I've already, I guess, have a brand. I might as well just, rather than start another brand, you know, keep with RPG Ramblings.
So at what point did you make the leap where you were like, okay, I'm tired of talking about this and I'm ready to do something?
It was after COVID or during COVID. There was, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Zine Quest.
Yep.
So Zine Quest is rolling out. I don't know if there had been a previous year, but anyway, I decided to do something. And the which end up being Scoundrels Make Your Game Criminal. And I had this idea and this thought. And so I just jumped into it and decided to put it on Kickstarter and do that. To kind of precede that, I think what helped me think that I could do something like that was the concept of a zine. Because if you think about like a book, if you say, you know what, I want to do a role-playing game, you look at a book, it's 8.5 by 11, and it's like, you know, 150 pages. You're like, I can't fill that much content. Like, I can't do that. But you take a piece of paper and you fold it in half, and you say, you know what, I can do 24 pages. I can do that. You can do that. Anybody can do that, right? I mean, it's not something that's unachievable. So I think once I was able to grok that there's a format that is smaller and that is doable and has less requirements, and that there was a means out there to expose the zines, and through Kickstarter, I decided that was the time to jump on, and so I did.
So I've noticed that through like a lot of your zines, you've had a lot of different talent work for you, write stuff for you. How does that happen? Like, do you have like a submission kind of thing? Like, hey, you want to write for RPG Ramblings kind of thing? And then these are the guidelines, submit something. We'll see if it's.
Yeah. I put that on a website. That doesn't work. You have to go shake the trees. You have to shake trees, right? People just don't drop in your lap. You can't be passive. So, you know, you got to look in the bushes, look for an Adam who seems unsuspecting. You just kind of sneak up on him. And so the thing is, you just have to reach out and be contacting people. And also you meet people who then introduce you to other people. So the first zine Journey of the Madlands, the second zine I did, I tried and do a collaboration with a number of people, and it both worked and also kind of failed at the same time, but it kind of got me started with working with a group of people. But yeah, it's not necessarily easy finding people.
I imagine that you have a strong vision of what it is that you're trying to achieve when you're making these things.
Yeah. And we can talk about that. Like, I had an initial, like with Scoundrels, there's a strong theme and a strong structure, but I would say, you know, and we can talk about this a bit later, but I would say all of issue one, but I think, was it issue two that you started, Adam, writing, or was it three? Yeah, it's two.
Issue two, issue one was, I like to say, it was more collaborative.
Yeah.
The most collaborative in the series, because we were doing a lot of, taking a lot of the stuff from Scoundrels,
Make
Your Game Criminal, and converting that, for a sci-fi setting and a new set of game mechanics.
Yep.
And so a lot had to be cut and changed and modified and completely reworked. And then by the second issue, Clean Hands, was when I started to kind of take the reins a little more. And
mostly
there was still a considerable amount of material that didn't make the first issue that was used in issue two. And then aside from your sage-like editorial guidance and help planning some heist scenarios, issue three and this latest one, issue four, have been pretty much.
Yeah. So I would say I built the foundation with the Scoundrels Make Your Game Criminal, but that's just the basement, the foundation, but the rest of it was probably largely Adam creating a lot of that stuff, especially the last few issues. Keep forgetting how many we've done.
We're on four.
Yeah. I was going to say. So let's kind of dive into that a little bit then. I kind of wanted to save that a little to the end, but I feel like this is a perfect place to talk about it. So what was the inspiration behind Scoundrels of Brixton?
So the initial was originally was going to be the my answer to the Cloud City of Bespin. You know, the idea where you have a floating city, where you have at the top, you have the elite. At the bottom, you have the people that are you know, dealing with the sludge from the people above, and then all in between, just a different levels of criminality that exist and oppression, and the idea that within the single ship, you could then have this ecosystem for running a criminal game. And so that was the original thought, but then it just started expanding out. The idea really was to, I don't know if you've ever watched The Expanse. So, you know, I think what I do not like about Star Wars, even though I love Star Wars, is that the idea is like they're just flying from planet to planet to planet to planet back and forth. It just doesn't make sense. But what I liked about The Expanse is it's very much a closed system, and things happen within that system. And so you can't, if it's small enough, players can't just escape consequences, right? The idea is things happen, and then they have to live in what they've dealt with. So the idea is create a smaller system and then create a history around that system and then explore crime themes within that. And like with each planet, having with that system also having an ability to kind of have a different theme was the concept. I think we pretty much have followed that, but I don't think we've really, I guess we do kind of have some planets as themes, but it's really not quite as thematic as it started out. But I think we are kind of branching out in that way, following themes.
So basically in the first issue Under a Hard Sun, you have the subsector, and then everything takes place within, you have the sector, or is it a part of a sector? And then you have the Brixton subsector that's within that. That's where all of the action happens.
So it's all in a subsector. The Brixton is a system. So there's just it's just a planetary system. And the idea was stuff was given so people could go out. Like, you know, it's like stuff was not heavily detailed, but there were details given to the things that surround it. There's a history of what's going on around it. So people want to get out of that, the microcosm, or we want to expand out past that. We have the hooks already built in. But really the intent was to start out is spend some time within the system and also spend some time on the planet, the Luvia. So, but we branched out since then. So, but that's the intent is to keep it focused, or people can just pull parts out of this as they choose and put it in whatever game they want.
So how did you get involved in this, Adam? So it sounds like, you know, you started off with the idea, Jeff, and then sort of began collaborating more with Adam.
It started out with the Make Your Game Criminal. So a book that is about, it's a supplement for really any sci-fi game where you can add criminal elements to it. It's got, you know, hooks and people, it's got locations, it's got all of that, but it was kind of not necessarily a fully fleshed out, it was not a fleshed out location as such, but more meant to be, you know, used however you choose to. But then with the Scoundrels of Brixton, that's when it started turning into more of a setting. And that's when Adam came on.
How did your DNA get melded into this, Adam? What was that process like?
Well, what happened was Jeffrey, after I had done a podcast with him, and he called me up one day. He said, "Hey, I got some ideas. I want to talk about this with you. I don't know what to do with it." So we were chatting on the phone. He's like, "Look, I made this Scoundrels Make Your Game Criminal. This is the supplement crime theme games. And, but I also have this idea for this solar system, the Brixton system. And, it's loosely based off of our own solar system. If you're in astrology, you'll definitely see the similarities, between the planets. And I kind of like, I didn't quite understand what he had at first or what he exactly wanted to do with it. But I said, "Hey, look, send me your notes and stuff. Let me take a look at it." And then I read his, a lot of his ideas for Brixton itself. And I was like, wow, this has so much potential. I just got super stoked about it. And, I had written a few things for Mongoose, J Tess, Traveler's Aid Society entries, you know, but I hadn't really like dove into role-playing game writing and development, but I just loved this Brixton system and the Planet Diluvia and Sky City and these, you know, these other, the whole concept of these corporate governments coming in from other solar systems and kind of plundering and exploiting, you know, the inhabitants of Brixton, who are really colonists from Earth, just trying to barely scrape by. And just the concept of how, just the nature of the environment itself, where one, you've got people just trying to eke out a living, and you've got these like technologically advanced, powerful, you know, other governments from other solar systems, and these massive corporations coming in and exploiting that, and just how it creates, it makes everybody in the system a scoundrel. Because being a scoundrel is just what everyone has to do to survive. And so I was just fascinated by it. And I said, Jeffrey, you know, just let me just go run wild with this and write and revise and take, you know, cherry pick some of these gangs, these criminal factions that he had developed in Scoundrels Agnostic, so to speak. And let me make it for sci-fi, and we can, you know, I believe it was Jeffrey who decided on using you know, Cephas engine mechanics, and I was just the more I just kind of kept adapting Scoundrels One, I was like, this is like great for people who play Homebrew Traveler or, you know, any kind of homebrew sci-fi using a 2D6 system, because you can be you can operate completely within the Brixton system, or like Jeff said, you can cherry pick certain non-player characters or factions or whatnot, or even planets, and insert them into virtually any campaign. Example I always use, and I kind of keep that in mind as I'm writing all the Scoundrels issues. And I don't know if I'm even allowed to say that it's compatible with Traveler for licensing, but I'm going to anyways. You know, like say someone's playing Pirates of Drynax, okay, which is a super popular and awesome campaign, you know, and Scoundrels of Brixton, the whole setting is super compatible with a campaign like that, or exactly that campaign. If you've got a party of space going miscreants, you know, you could just simply add the solar system, the Brixton solar system, into the star map and include it as part of the adventure. Or say you're running your homebrew classic Traveler campaign that you've been running for years, and the Astrogator rolls a misjump, and you need somewhere for your ship to emerge from jump space, and then all of a sudden, pop, they're in this Brixton solar system forced to deal with everything that's going on there and choose whether to stay or stay, just make it kind of maybe a place that you visit every now and then. There was just so much potential I saw in Scoundrels of Brixton that I was just like super jazzed about it. And I was thrilled, you know, Jeffrey brought me on board and gave me the freedom to kind of run wild with it.
Nice. I do agree, as someone who's run, I had an over a year long Pirates of Drynax campaign. And when I wished that I would have been aware of this when I was running it, because this is the exact kind of material that I would have used in my game. So often I would like steal or have these little side quests. I think my players actually enjoyed the side stuff more than the actual campaign.
Right.
So now we've got issue 4 is coming, the Savage Frontiers. So what aspect of this issue of the zine, what does that cover in Brixton?
Okay. So we basically in the first two issues, the action was centered on Sky City and the system's main world of Diluvia. In issue 3, we went to this planet, planet Unov, and dealt with just the mysterious goings on the planet, in addition to the fact that it's a great hangout for criminals to lay low. And if there's the, we delved into Brixton's narcotics trade and all that. So, some other areas though, in the system that needed to be looked at was, a very small planet, called Voronka, which plays a role in, it appears in all three of the first three issues. And also in the outer system, the asteroid belts by the gas giants. So it, those two areas are, they're rich with possibilities for adventuring, but they're also very small. So filling an entire issue with, you know, the planet Voronka, where there's probably about 600 inhabitants, is Mercury. Challenging. Yeah, it's the planet Mercury, basically, and there's it's inhabited very sparsely. And so I made the decision. I was like, well, why don't we just combine these two areas, these two settings in Brixton, essentially the frontier areas of Brixton. And that's what this issue four you know, centers around, the planet Voronka. And then just in all the inhabited moons in the near the two gas giants in the Brixton system, what's going on out there, cities in the asteroid belts, just the people who inhabit deep space. And they're all criminals.
You have to have criminals. It's the only way to make things interesting. If everybody's on the up and up, you don't have any drama. We need some, you know, you need to have some kind of crime going on.
The core inspiration was, I mean, if we go back to, for me, the original was Blades in the Dark. I don't know if you know if you've ever played Blades in the Dark.
I haven't played it. I've heard of it. It sounds really cool.
But everybody's a crew, or every group's a crew, and there's other crews that they're opposed. And one of the premises, there are no good people. So it's not that there's no good people in the city, but it's never, you're never attacking the other groups that you're against. None of them are good. So you're not attacking good people, but it's the idea of levels of bad attacking other people that are vying for power. So that was kind of the inspiration, was that idea that it's not that there aren't really anybody good in the entire solar system, but the fact is all these people that you're dealing with are bad. So you can choose to work with them. You can choose to work with against them. You can choose for them as patrons. You could maybe even pay them to do jobs for you. It is really up to the players and the GM how they want to handle that. Because we're not really dictating these are bad guys or good guys, or these are protagonists or antagonists or whatever. These are simply these people, and you choose how you want to deal with them. We give you some ideas in different ways, but we don't prescribe how to use them.
And that's something that Savage Frontier issue 4 does. One thing it does is it kind of is in a similar format to Scoundrels 1, Under a Hard Sun. So when we established the setting in the very first issue, issues 2 and 3 kind of saw the setting evolve, the supplements evolve to where they focused on a single criminal gang. You had the Clean Hands, you had the Phantoms of Unov, and these were different. It was more of an expansion of a criminal faction, and the referee and the players could decide whether they wanted to play as that faction, join them. They could be enemies, as Jeff said, but this issue 4 kind of goes back to a similar format as issue 1, because you have to lay out a lot of information about key players and key locations, and then include you know, segments on the criminal factions that inhabit these areas, and the non-player characters who may not be part of a gang, but they're also kind of shady. So issue 4, for people who liked issue 1, I guess is what I'm saying, this issue 4, Savage Frontier, kind of goes back to that similar familiar format that people fell in love with Scoundrels in the first place.
Nice. I like that. I definitely enjoyed the first issue. I mean, I enjoyed them all, but I could see the appeal to that. I'm curious, Jeff, So you, I don't know whose decision, if it was your decision or if you guys both came to that about your choice to use Cepheus. Why, saying, since you're, one of your inspirations was Blade in the Dark, Blades in the Dark, why not use something like to create your own sort of futuristic version of Blades in the Dark, or let's say Stars Without Numbers? Why Cepheus?
Well, I think I wanted to do, to be frank, I really wanted this to be a Traveler project. And at the time, the Traveler, there was an OGL, but it was very volatile during that time. So Cepheus Engine is probably the easiest choice as far as that goes. I did not, and it's already, I mean, the thing is not only does it seem to, you know, have kind of a fit, because I like Blades in the Dark, but I don't necessarily would want a sci-fi. They have like Scum Villainy. I didn't necessarily want to do that, or Scum Villainy, yeah. So, but what I really wanted to do was, it was that feeling I wanted. And I love Traveler. That's really what I wanted to do it for. And Cepheus Engine really was the means to make it Traveler without it being, you know, officially Traveler and facing litigation.
Talking about, so not only does, you know, do you do the work for RPG Ramblings, Adam, but you also have your own imprint, Boondock RPG Adventures. So you have, again, these are all like 2D6 Cepheus Engine compatible. I think you're up to, is it 10 now or 9?
Where issue 9 was just released earlier this month. Right now, the issues are coming out monthly. So next month, and about on the 15th of October, we'll release issue 10. It's been a lot of fun so far, and I think I like the feedback I'm getting from other people. They seem pretty receptive to it, and I'm thrilled that it actually is something that that people are enjoying. And like one of the things Jeffrey always, you know, wants with his supplements, and especially Scoundrels, just to create more independent content that's useful for a referee to be able to either run as is, or, you know, cherry pick for whatever game they happen to be running. So yeah, Hard Vacuum, it's going strong. It's not stopping. And I'm just thrilled that it's found some success in the world right now.
I really love them. They're, you know, tight little adventures. I'm assuming that these are compatible with Scoundrels of Brixton. I don't see why
they absolutely are. They all use, you know, I use the same as with Scoundrels. I use the 2016 Cepheus Engine SRD. I just decided to use that, and making it compatible with anybody running, you know, Homebrew 2D6 or with Traveler or with whatnot. And it originated, honestly, Hard Vacuum originated because I simply had more ideas for non-player characters and adventure scenarios than Jeffrey had issues of Scoundrels to publish. I had all this material, and he was actually really encouraging, saying, why don't you break out on your own and do this? I had never intended to be a publisher. I don't want to run a business. I didn't want to do any of that. And it was a little intimidating, to be quite honest, to go off and start your own role-playing game publishing imprint. But he was really encouraging about that. And he was like, no, go out and make your own thing, man. And so I just did, and I kind of rolled the dice, and here we are. And, I wanted to make something, it's similar to, it's not, if Scoundrels is system agnostic, Hard Vacuum is setting agnostic, I guess. I wanted something where, like you had brought up earlier, like side quests, one shots, an adventure that you could run at a con, something that takes maybe, you know, 3 to maybe 5 hours max. That's easy for a referee to run. They can put it in basically anywhere. And they can bring in existing characters. They can roll characters right there on the spot or use pre-gens and just make it super flexible and fun for everyone involved at the table.
Yeah, I remember Jason Hobbs talking, I think it was on Hex Talk, one of his podcasts, and he was talking about good vanilla. Good vanilla is something that you need for if you want to run a good hex crawl or a good sandbox style D&D kind of game. And I feel like in a lot of respects, that's what these hard vacuum, and not to disrespect, like I don't want that to sound disrespectful to you, but it sounds like that's what hard vacuum is it's good vanilla where, you know, the referee doesn't need to do a lot of work to file off the serial numbers to get it to fit into his game and can really adapt it, or their game, I should say. So I guess this is directed at both of you. So maybe we could start with Jeff and then go to you, Adam. What's your creative process like when you're sitting down to like work on these kinds of things for the zines?
That's a good question. I get some sort of feeling of something that I need to get out of my system. And then I sit at a keyboard and I write till I get it out of my system. And that's, I don't know, that's a really good answer, but do you
have like a time that you're like, okay, I'm going to sit at this keyboard from this time to this time and hopefully something happens. And if it doesn't, okay, we'll try next. Or is it just all of a sudden I feel compelled and then you just start writing?
So there's a compulsion to write to do a thing. So whether it was the Scoundrels or whether it's, you know, Blood Sands or whether it's during the Madlands or whatever it may be. And so then what I'll do is I'll sit down and write. What I will say is I'm not at all a great writer. I'm not trying to say that I have the answer to any of this, but what I do is I just sit down and I write, and I do not get writer's block. I just write, and then I write and write and write and see where it leads me. And I write and write and see where it leads me. And then I go back and say, okay. And a lot of times what I'll write is I'll write things in such a way that I will put in, we'll say, proper nouns and themes or whatever that I've not defined. And then I'll go back and look at those and then go back and define those. And then I'll look at the overall what I've got and say, okay, what am I missing, or what things do I need to expand on, or what things do I need to change? And then I go back and I then will go back and start revising it. But it's not very efficient. But when it comes to just writing that kind of content, or even if it's writing like Gary's appendix for the best year, I just sit down, I just start writing, and just work my way through it.
It sounds like what like writers of like novels and stuff would call like a pantser.
I am a pantser. In fact, I'm thinking about doing an imprint, calling it Prancer Press.
So how about
very
you,
much
Adam?
A pantser.
How about you, Adam? You're a published author of fiction. You were a journalist. How is your creative approach? How do you pursue writing? And
yeah, I can go into it, and I'll probably ramble a little bit. So try to stay with me, but hopefully I'll bring it home in the end. You know, one of the things that I like about role playing games, one of the things I still love, it's probably my most favorite thing, and it's probably why I was drawn to Traveler as a kid, is character generation. Like I freaking love character generation, man. I love like not just rolling dice and you know, creating back and buying all the stuff, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, the equipment a character has is kind of based off of their personality too. You know, what kind of weird musical instrument will the bard have? You know, so I really love that aspect of role-playing games. And the thing Jeffrey initially wanted to bring me on board for with Scoundrels before I took over was to create a criminal faction. So I did. And I really like sitting and just thinking, okay, what's this one character? And okay, he's a criminal and he's a leader of a gang. Okay, so who are the henchmen? And so I start making those. And like, okay, well, what's their story? What do they do? You know, in the Clean Hands, they're smugglers. You know, in Phantoms of Unov, they're narcotics manufacturers. It's Breaking Bad in outer space. You know, they're on a spaceship and they've got a drug lab and they're flying around. You know,
science, just, you know, bitch.
Yeah, and it's you know, I'm saying, like, what kind of people would do this kind of stuff? So I like that aspect of it, and so that's where I start. I start with basically one character who happens to be a leader of a crime faction or just a party of adventurers. And then I go from there, and then I actually roll these characters, and I'll roll and roll and roll till I get the character I want. And then the same with the henchmen, and then their backstories, their companions, and the equipment they have and whatnot. And then I'll, for like with Scoundrels, when once I have the main faction for that issue, like issue 2 or issue 3 established, I'll start making scenarios that they can get into that they might need the player characters to assist them with, or that the player characters have been hired to foil if the players are enemies. And so I'll start building that. And then, well, this main crime faction, the centerpiece gang, like in Clean Hands or, you know, Phantoms of Unov, well, they need adversaries. Who's their competitors? You know, who wants them out of the way? Is it the authorities? Is it another crime faction? Is it both? What are they like? Who's in charge of them? And so it kind of just spins off almost like a mosaic family tree kind of process. But it all starts with one character, one idea for a character and their personality and their backstory that I think is just cool. And then I just let it roll. And so a big challenge, though, especially like with say a Scoundrels adventure scenario or something for Hard Vacuum, is the space constraints as well. You can't just run wild with that. Now, I think like most adventure scenarios or hooks, whatever you want to call them, in Scoundrels, it's about 160 words of space. So it's not a lot. So you have to be pretty choosy in terms of what information that you're providing, because you've got to give the referee everything that they need to be able to spin this out and expand on it to run at their table. But fortunately, you know, I worked as a newspaper reporter for a few years, and I was on the night crime shift. So I would have to be able to write my stories to fit a small news hole. So I can hit those kind of small spaces. And as a fiction writer, I don't write big 400 page books. You know, my debut novel, The Surge, is, I think, 200 pages, you know. And I think people appreciate that. I mean, some people love to just sit with a giant door stopper of a book, and other people like a book that is portable, that they can finish in a weekend, that they can easily pack in a backpack or a suitcase and take while traveling. So I guess the closest thing I can describe it in terms of role-playing game writing, whether it be for Journal of the Traveler's Aid Society or Hard Vacuum or Scoundrels, is it's the closest. It's close to what's called flash fiction, really short stories that can, you know, flash fiction. A flash fiction story is only maybe 100 words if you do it right, and it's an art in and of itself. And so I think I have a lot of, in terms of writing and in terms of writing talents, I can do a lot in a small space is what I guess is necessary, and it requires its own skill sets.
Would you say then that you're a pantser as well, essentially?
Oh, absolutely. I cannot outline at all. I cannot it stays kind of locked in my head. I mean, I make outlines, I make notes, but most of them are mental notes. I do have lists. I should get more organized and actually make spreadsheets, but I've got, you know, like just a file of names for characters. My God, I mean, there are how many NPCs do we have in all the Scoundrels issues? I mean, there are hundreds, there's over 100, and coming up with different names for all these different characters gets to be challenging after a while, and especially same with Hard Vacuum. So keeping track of all of them and coming up with new ones and whatnot is where any administrative writing, that's what I do.
You're not using it, but I've got a spreadsheet that I took like five people groups, went through baby names, and I randomly generate to mix them together. So it's like West African, Indian, you know, Chinese and whatever, and randomizes that. But I'd say for me also, the thing I failed to mention, I like randomizing adjectives and creatures. So I do spreadsheets on randomized things and kind of use that for inspiration, what, you know, thing comes up. But going back to the Scoundrels of Brixton, M's not wrong. We are, the format, I don't know if you look through it, it is tight. The formatting is tight. There's no opportunity just to go on and prattle about something. It's got to be concise, and it's got to have all the information. Ab's done a fantastic job being able to keep with that format.
I think that's one of the things that I really appreciate about these zines is that, like you said, you have so much, it's so densely packed with information, NPCs, factions, you know, hooks. Like the layout is brilliant. It's readable. You know, you've got this beautiful map from Glenn Seal in here. I mean, the cover art is very evocative and really sets the tone of what you can expect. I mean,
the new spaceships.
Yeah, new spaceships.
Totally new spaceships.
Okay, I'm going to admit, I'm not a spaceship head guy. I know there's like some traveler people who are like, we need more spaceships. I don't understand. Why there's no room for this engine in here, dude. Like, did you not? Anyway, that's not really my thing, but I can understand why people would be excited about the spaceships. Cause there's people that love gear. They love spaceships and they love being able to build all that stuff and do all that stuff too. Yeah, I hope that didn't come off like condescending or anything.
Oh,
like
no.
No, but it's an excellent point, because you want to appeal to a wide swath of gamers. I mean, one of the things Jeffrey always emphasizes, this has to be useful, you know, so you've got to be able to appeal to all the different things that everybody likes about gaming. Like you said, some people, they just want adventures, and some people want just tons of NPCs to use. Some people like gear. Some people want new spaceships. Some people want to do bean counting kind of adventures. So, I mean, it can be challenging as a creator to, you know, fit all this under an umbrella, and especially in a zine, you know, the size of a Scoundrels issue or Hard Vacuum, that is going to appeal to the most people. You know, some people like aliens, you know, you got to, it's challenging because we want people to enjoy this. I'm speaking for you, Jeff, but you know, we want people to not only find this useful, but fun to run at their table. And that can be a little challenging, but so far, so good. I know, An Adventure from Scoundrels, issue one was a hit over at TravCon in the UK last year. And next month, a Hard Vacuum, scenario is being run at the same convention. So we'll see how that pans out. But I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I highly recommend that people back this if they're even remotely interested. The price point is fabulous, especially if you want to get caught up on all the issues, or if you want to get some other fantastic RPG rambling stuff. I mean, even the Hard Vacuum stuff is very well priced. Like I feel like you know, I'm getting my money's worth for what you're putting out.
Thanks, man.
So I'm kind of curious, what can we expect after this for the Scoundrelverse? Because it seems to me like, I mean, you wouldn't be doing a Kickstarter if it hasn't been successful so far. So I'm guessing that there's more to come. What can we expect?
That's a good question. I think Adam's always got some ideas brewing in his head. I don't know that anything has come to paper yet, but.
No, the issue 5 in the Scoundrels of Brixton series will be worth the price of admission. I if you've liked the content so far, it's going to be very, I'm excited about it. I'll let people be the judge on whether it's good or not, but I'm very excited about it. And it's going to, kind of tie everything from the first 4 issues together. So all the dots are going to be connected, and all the gangs and criminal factions and governments are all going to tie into the overall conflict within the issue. And we'll be exploring the last planet. Most of the action will be centered on the last planet in the Brixton system, the planet Buey, which we haven't really done a deep dive in as we have done with every other planet so far. There's one stone left unturned, and we're going to flip it over and then pick up that stone, and we're going to throw it through a glass window of a church.
I mean, I don't know if I can condone throwing rocks through churches, but you know, hey, I'm not going to tell you what to do with your rocks, okay?
They're scoundrels. What do you expect them to do? It's just like, I don't make the rules.
Listen, man, this podcast isn't making any money. I can't afford to be sued. So I'm a little curious, Adam, because so you wrote a book. I know you had talked, so your book is called The Surge. I bought it. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm super excited to dig in.
Cool, man.
And I know you had talked to, Jeff earlier on about, now my camera's acting up. As soon as I start moving my hands, it starts to follow me. So you had spoken, I guess it was like a number of years ago at this point, about you had written like a traveler novella and were trying to get some traction for that. Are we going to see some kind of a science fiction novella type thing, like, you know, related to Brixton or related to Hard Vacuum or something to that effect in the future?
I hope so. What I did with the traveler novella is I just basically went back to the drawing board and took out all the IP. So it's not a traveler novella anymore. But I guess if this, and I rewrote the whole thing and I'm shopping it to various publishers who publish that kind of material of that length, novella publishing, or it's a short novel now. It's about 50,000 words. And it's can be tough to find a market for that. But the only way I can describe it, if I was given the elevator pitch, is it's The Expanse meets Lovecraft Country. That's the best way to describe it. Space-going monster hunters? That's the thing. And hopefully, you know, I can find a home for it. I think it's a good story. I think it's a lot of fun to read. And we'll see. I mean, you know, whether or not it's it ever gets published or not, as the writer, you don't have as much control over that as you think. Writing and publishing are two different things in terms of fiction. It's really not a case of if you build it, they will come. But who knows? Like I said, it's being looked at by some publishers and. We'll see what they have to say, but I like it. You know, I guess the premise of that story is, you know, when humanity finally developed the technology for interstellar spaceflight, you know, they loaded starships with all their technology and culture and art and their best and brightest, and they blasted off to explore the stars. And all the monsters and demons hitched a ride. So you know, like I said, if you like Expanse, if you like, you know, Call of Cthulhu or Lovecraft Country type stuff, it's a pretty, I think it's a pretty good mashup of that. And I don't think many people have done anything like that. And if you read it, you will catch a role-playing game kind of vibe. Just like if you read the Expanse novels, you're like, oh man, these guys played Traveler. You could tell with certain things, you're like, oh, these guys played role-playing games. So readers of that, if anyone ever does read it, will pick up on that, and hopefully they appreciate it.
Nice. So Jeff, for RPG Ramblings, what can we expect on the horizon after Scoundrels comes out?
So after Scoundrels is Dark Devilry. So that will be the next Shadow Dark supplement that we will be produced. It's actually been written by a gaggle of writers. And so that will be right hot on the heels.
I'm curious, you've like begun, you know, digging into the Shadow Dark community, feels like a very voracious community. Do you feel like Shadow Dark has started to overshadow the OSE community? Do you feel like OSE was had its time in the sun and now Shadow Dark is taking over? Or do you think that these two are going to live in harmony in the balance of RPGs?
So this is interesting because Shadow Dark is a new hotness. So, and I think that there's probably a number of reasons for it. I don't think it's going to, I think the OSE is going to continue to be strong. I don't know whether to go on a long tirade or not, but I do think the short, if you want a short answer,
Jeff, unleash it, unleash the beast. Okay, tell us how you really feel, man.
So from a publisher standpoint, because I've published for this is going to be a little bit of a long ride, but since you asked for it. So I published for DCC, I published for OSE, I published for Cephas Engine, I published for Shadow Dark. And so in general, I'm just going to say I've got a feeling that the Cephas Engine community it's never been huge, but it doesn't seem as strong as it was a year ago or 2 years ago. And in fact, looking at the Facebook pages, I hardly see any posts.
Are you talking Cepheus Engine, like Cepheus Engine, or are you talking about Traveler in general?
I mean, Cepheus Engine products that third party people have been producing, okay, or the community itself under the Cepheus Engine. I don't see it as strong. I do see with OSE, the success has been mediocre. And you know, I enjoy the product and I don't want to downsell, but it is hard to make sales with Cephas Engine.
Okay.
There's an opportunity to go to the Traveler. I've thought about doing conversion, but that is not an easy market. So OSE is a pretty easy market. It's wide open. It's probably a little bit harder to distinguish yourself, but there's a lot of variety because most people do not follow because most people are publishing their own thing, but using OSE rules. They're not necessarily following Necrotic Gnomes, we'll say, style.
Right.
But they've just released, so Dolmenwood has just come out. It's in PDF, but that's a new setting and new rules. So they're also offering a third party program where you can make stuff for it and basically get an easy third party license. and publish. So I think what's going to happen, I don't know if you've looked at the new Doman Wood setting.
I've seen it. It looks gorgeous. And I have like humongous amounts of FOMO for not backing it. I really was like, at the time I was trying to cut down on how much I was backing, and my wife was like enthusiastic that I stopped buying stuff. And now I see everybody getting their stuff and I'm like, oh, why? But go ahead.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So I think that has a potential to shake things up in a way. May not go full on Shadow Dark, but I think that he has produced a product, I'll just call it a product, that is very different. It's got he really went with an angle that both connects, I think, to mythology and fantasy that we can kind of relate to, but also in a direction that ties in what we're used to with fantasy, but also adding a weird twist to the whole thing. So I think that's going to be good. So they're going to be allowing third-party people to be publishing. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at that point. So I think that will breathe life into what seems to be at this point where with really, other than a few adventures, they've not done a whole lot, right? Necrotic Gnome. They are also, I don't know if you know, they were doing they're working on, long delayed, a post-apocalyptic game. Did you know that?
I did not know that. I was wondering, because I was reading in the Madlands, which was something else I would love to talk about. I'm sure I'm going to have you on again at some point, and probably you too, Adam. But so was that when you were putting out, because it sounded like you were using other dust at first.
Yeah.
And then you had mentioned in the I think it's in the second Madlands book about you were waiting for an OSC version of a post-apocalypse thing. And I wasn't sure if that was from Necrotic Gnome or something else.
Yeah. It's crazy. People bought a product for a setting that doesn't exist and for a rule set that doesn't exist. So I really appreciate that aspect of it. But yeah, so they're supposed to. It's been long delayed. So then they're also coming up with a demon book.
Mm.
That's coming out next year, and they're going to, they have a lot, and I'm also part, I may be part of that. So that's going to be released first quarter of next year. So I think between the Doman Wood finally print coming in, the physical product comes in people's hands, the demon book product, OSR Demons, OSC Demons is going to, I think, revitalize that community. And Shadow Dark is still going to keep going strong, I think. What's interesting is the Shadow Dark people are willing to spend money. More so, like, say, if I put a product out for DCC, super community, super supportive community, but they'll almost only buy PDFs.
Mm.
The OSE people, if you do a hardback versus soft cover, they pretty much almost always will buy soft cover or the physical copies over PDFs, but it may be a mix between hardcover and soft cover if you offer that. But Shadow Dark people, hardcovers all the way for the most part. And so
interesting.
So, but what's hard is, you know, if you're going to do something for Shadow Dark, you kind of have to do something that stands out, right? Because it's hot, people are going to be producing for. So there's a lot of stuff coming out, but whatever you do, you're going to have to do. But I think OSE is not languishing. I think it's things are about to hit. And then also between their products releases and with the third parties that they're encouraging to write product that with a very open license, but I think Shadow Dark is going to continue to remain strong.
Okay, cool. So is there anything that I didn't ask you guys that you feel like is super relevant in terms of the Kickstarter, which, by the way, just in case this episode is coming out on Monday, and the Kickstarter ends Wednesday, October 8th, 2025. So from the airing of this episode, there'll be 10 days left to back. I really think that You should. I've already backed it and I'm super excited. And you've always been a very reliable person when it comes to Kickstarters. So that's something that I really appreciate. So was there something that I missed or anything that you wanted to add?
Well, I guess I will say that it's written. The layout is done. I've got some, we've gone back and forth with some revisions. I got one more revision to do to hand to Adam. So once we get that revision done and we're all both good with it, I'll be ordering proof copies. And so people who are backing, as with most of my Kickstarters, it will be a pretty short amount of time between when the backer kit closes and, or between when Kickstarter ends, backer kit opens, and then we start fulfilling product.
It looks good, Jeffrey. I mean, he's really good with the layout. So, and it's looking great. We've just got just a few minor tweaks probably to make and just to double check a few things, but it looks good. And just like with all the other Scoundrels issues, backers will be fulfilled really quick. You're not going to wait a year for this. This is ready to go. And Jeffrey's always pretty expedient about getting them out to the backers. I will say another thing, you know, you talked about, the affordability of the Scoundrels issues. Backing the project through the Kickstarter is probably the most inexpensive way to pick up an issue as opposed to whether you wanted to get it, down the road. And it's a great value if you're new to the series and you want to get up on the back issues and whatnot, you know, getting those as a bundle or whatnot is probably the most affordable way. Am I correct?
Yeah. Especially the bundles. Yeah. So it's definitely affordable. We try and keep the prices in such at a price point that it's not that people are able to buy them. We're not pricing these things at high levels. So, but it's also,
but getting it through the Kickstarters is like the best way. That's where you get the best way, right? Is that, yeah,
it does. And I will also say that really by supporting Kickstarters, it is really a vote, right? So if Kickstarters don't do well, there's less incentive to keep going. And, you know, I do enjoy sales, back issues, through other Kickstarters I do and also through my website, but that definitely is a vote and people vote with their wallet. So I would say not just me, but if anybody's producing product that you love and they do Kickstarters, it's good to support in some way the Kickstarters, because that's kind of an indicator of really, you know, of the health of the product. But I will also say we pack most every issue up to 48 pages. So I do fulfillment in a way that I can do it cost effectively throughout the world. But by doing the POD for non-US backers, I'm at a 48 page limit. So we pretty much pack in 48 pages, I think, pretty close to every single issue. So we're given content. So there's not, these aren't just small zines. These are packed.
Yeah, no, I definitely concur. And I think, you know, both, I think, like I said, the content is fabulous. And then just your speediness, the rapidness at which you fulfill your Kickstarters is another thing that really, you know, gave me a boost of confidence. And so that was why I ended up picking up almost everything that you have. I'm still missing some things, but I plan to rectify that sooner or later. All right. So I could talk to you guys. I think each one of you has so many... There were so many points during this conversation where I was like, oh, I could take a left turn down here and we could talk about that a little bit. So I think I'm going to have you guys on again, probably individually, so we can dig deeper down some of these rabbit holes. But one of the things about the Dungeon Plunger podcast is that we my goal has always been to try to produce better game masters. So if I could ask each one of you, what would be one piece of advice that you would give either a new or veteran game master in being able to run a better game? We can start with whichever one of you feels ready to rock and roll first.
So what I will, I guess I'll start. I will say that if anybody wants to do something that's a bit crazy, like very crazy, but it will be cool, rather than saying no, pull out a six-sider and say, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. One, two, three, four. This goes terrible. And these are the consequences that will happen when you fail. Five or six, you succeed. And if you state the stakes and you don't skimp on the stakes, you make them severe, but you give them a reasonable chance. And then people roll the dice. You'll generate so much excitement at the table, no matter what the result is. So I would say that be willing to open to the players doing crazy things, but you need to make it be a hard decision and there'd be consequences if they fail, but also always a chance that they succeed.
I love that. That's a great piece of advice. I feel like you're the kind of guy that has a special D6 that you pull out just for these kinds of occasions, Jeff.
Well, it could just be even, you know, I did with an OSC adventure once where people wanted some crazy things. It's like, well, you know, you can do this extra move. You can do this crazy thing. But if you roll, your decks are under, or you fall into the pit and die. And it was a TPK at the end, but they won, but everybody's excited. So it was a win. Everybody had a good time. Like, they defeated the bad guy, almost a true TPK, and there's a couple people left standing, not understanding what just happened. But
sometimes those are the best adventures. How about you, Adam?
This is the tough one because I am, other than maybe running a few, like, a one shot of like Boot Hill or Top Secret, and maybe a little, maybe a second edition AD&D module. I have been a player my entire life. So what advice though for a referee or dungeon master or whatever that I can bring, it comes from a player's perspective, and some of the best guys have a plan B. Okay. You need to expect and prepare for your players to go
correct your beaten path.
Yeah. And the best referees, game masters, DMs have a plan for that, and the flow of the game, the action runs real smooth. What you don't want is to be, let's use Traveler Cephas Engine for example, and your astrogator rolls a misjump. And the ship, and it comes up with the ship reappears in another system several light years away. And you have no plan for that. You as the referee have not prepared for the eventuality of that. Or what if the players just go off down a different road? And the best DMs expect that. They've got a plan for that to happen. So that would be my advice. Always have a bunch of side quests ready to go, or non-player characters and little things, and just so that you're more prepared to at least make that transition to the unexpected or through the unexpected a little easier, not only for yourself but for your players.
I like it. Great advice. I'm a little surprised that as someone who is an author and who's been writing these adventures and all that kind of stuff, that you're not normally a game master. Like that really shocks me.
No,
I'm shocked.
But really,
I'm like, I don't know, because to me, I always feel like people who like enjoy writing adventures. Okay, so I understand that there's a difference between a game designer and somebody who like creates adventures and stuff like that. But I often feel that like people who are compelled to write adventures tend to be the ones that want to sit down at the table and run the game.
Not me, man. I just want to roll. I want to swing a sword. I want to roll skill checks. I want to make up a crazy backstory and act that out. That's my jam.
Well, but if you look at like the adventures and scoundrels, I mean, they're more narrative, right? We're not prescribing that, you know, there's six guards and seven dogs and giving a map of a compound. It's simply just, it's a story structure, really what it is, right? This is a scenario. This is a plot. This is a start of a story.
And that's what I meant when I said earlier, it's kind of like writing flash fiction. It's right, you know, the scenarios that we write for Scoundrels and to a larger extent in the Hard Vacuum series, it's like short fiction. It's up to the referee. If you want to have 20 adversaries, that's up to you, man. I mean, we'll provide a handful with some stats ready to rock, but the referee has to have maximum flexibility to tailor this to whatever environment they're running the game in. And that's credit to Jeff, because he's pretty religious about sticking to that. And so, yeah, it's our scenarios are little short stories. I have a master's of fine arts in creative writing from Northwestern. but I mean, I tell people, you know, I get my pipe, my ascot here, you know, but when I write an adventure scenario for a role-playing game, I employ the same craft techniques as if I was writing a novel. It's just in 160 words. And my journalism training has taught me to be choosy about how I package the information and what I can omit and what is essential.
I mean, I guess, so I think that that's the key is what you're talking about is that, you know, you describe it as telling a story and you're being very economical with how you do it, which I think is key because I think there's too many, I shouldn't say too many. I don't know what I'm talking about here, but I think that there are a lot of amateur writers or game masters when they get into the game early on and they're like, I want to tell a story, and they go off and they want to write a novel, or you get player characters who, want to write a novel about their backstory. And the thing is that from my perspective, what you're doing when you have like, I guess, you know, because they're so concise and small and they give you the tools and they're not dictating how to run the adventure. They're just saying, here's a bunch of stuff, throw it in the sandbox for your players and then see what happens. And that's kind of how I approach running games these days. You know, I used to be like the Pathfinder guy. I love to have my encounters. I love to have my little tactical battles, and I still like tactical fighting and I still enjoy that kind of stuff. But the last time that I went back to play Pathfinder, I was like, something's shifted in how I play games now. And now I am a little bit more of a storyteller, which might be blasphemy to some people, like, it's not a story, dude. But I honestly feel like the games that I enjoy the most are the ones that have the most flexibility, that have the most freedom for the players to be able to choose how they're going to deal with the situation, and that something isn't, you know, prescribed to them about how to do it. You feel like you look like you're going to say something, Jeff. Go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, no, you're exactly right. It's just that the idea is that, right, the story emerges, right? You're setting, but I think as you get older, I mean, you're interested in the combat, but as you get older, you want to know, but what's the story? And we know kind of the start of the story, but which is much more, I love combat as much as everybody else, but in the end, when you're done with an adventure, you want to at least have a thought, like there was a good solid story, not just I had three good battles and I shot seven guys. Well, you know, maybe there's some epic moments that were part of that story, but in the end, that's not that interesting and I think that's part of the problem with fourth edition. You know, I would love to play it someday. I never have, but it's just when I look at the modules, it was just simply a battle, a little narrative, get you to the next battle mat, then you have another battle. You know, it's like, that's not interesting. But it's interesting when you're young because, you know, you just love the action and the mechanics and the character builds. But I think as we get older, we're wanting something more nuanced, right? We want the satisfaction of, wow, that was a satisfying conclusion to the situation that we were in.
I get what you're saying, Jeffrey, but you know what, man? I'm playing a fifth edition D&D campaign right now. The DM is friggin' awesome, but I'm telling you, it's just fighting. We are just, it's old school busting heads, hack and slash. I mean, and there's just little bits to transition us, but you know the next fight is coming, man. As soon as we take the long rest and heal up, we're gonna get ambushed by a bunch of goblins. These bandits are gonna show up. There's gonna be a giant, plants are gonna come alive and start. I mean, and it's just like crazy town. So I know what you're saying. Like, especially as you get older, you want a little more rich, you know, narrative in there. But man, it is kicking ass is fun, man.
Oh, I don't disagree. What I'm just saying is, but night after night,
it still rocks.
That would get old, you know, if it was a whole campaign of that. But you're saying, you know what, we're going to, for the next few nights, we're just going to go wild. That's one thing. But
one thing I want people to know about Scoundrels, as well as Hard Vacuum stuff, the scenarios, okay, while they're, I like to think, well-written, it's good storytelling, and it's useful for the ref. One thing I try to put into everything is that, especially in sci-fi, I love, like, or any role-playing game, I love buying gear. I love buying equipment for my character, right? And I know I'm not alone. And at some point, man, you want to use the Gauss pistol with the, you know, intelligent weapon system. You want to use all this stuff that you bought. And so when I write these Scoundrels scenarios or Hard Vacuum adventures, the opportunity to use everything, all the weird stuff that your characters have bought is there. And that requires some action, if that makes sense.
Facts, man. Speak it, brother. All right. So this has been a fabulous conversation with the two of you. I am so appreciative of you guys both coming onto the show. I'm appreciative for the work that you guys have done, both, you know, together and separately. It's fantastic, and I can't recommend it enough. Again, back to Kickstarter, Scoundrels of Brixton, Savage Frontier, number 4 zine. You still got time. So yeah, again, I just wanted to say thank you very much, Jeff and Adam, for being on the show and helping me plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Also, everybody, because I did another interview not too long ago, and we were talking, and I was like, oh yeah, I have a Facebook page, but it's not doing so good. I have like maybe like 11 people that are following me. And the dude was like, you have a Facebook page? I don't know you have a Facebook page. And I'm like, well, it's in the show notes. And he's like, dude, I don't look at show notes. I don't look at no stinking show notes. And so I'm like, you know what? I bet you there's a shit ton of people who listen to this, never looked at the show notes, have no idea that I have a Facebook page. Or even that I have a TikTok. I had a TikTok. I've tried doing TikTok stuff. So I'm not saying like go onto my TikTok and you're going to be like, oh my God, this dude is like the next TikTok master. But I'm on Instagram. I'm on Blue Sky, Facebook, X. And so I would really appreciate it if I could get a little bit of boost there. I'd really like to expand the reach of the podcast so that more people can hear about the cool stuff that people like Jeff and Adam are doing. But until next time, Union members, plungers up. Adam, you didn't put your plunger up, dude. Come on, man. That's Union solidarity, everybody. And for the people who are only listening, everybody has their fist up right now. Dungeon Plunger!
Dungeon Plunger!
And Dungeon Plunger.
All right. Talk to you guys later. That's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. It is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that Linguinion's Jason. If you want to hear more interviews like this one, follow us and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your neighbors, random strangers, the people living in the wall, the troll that lives under the bridge, the guardian of the lost city, everyone! It means the world to us that you share our podcast and make our numbers bigger. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.